Hello, and welcome to the Comics Ate My Brain Weekly Roundup Podcast. I'm Tom Bondurant, and this week we'll be looking at new comics from July 15th, 2009, specifically Action Comics 879, Agents of Atlas number 8, Batman Streets of Gotham number 2, Blackest Night number 1, Blackest Night Tales of the Corps number 1, Brave and the Bold number 25, Captain America number 601, JSA vs. Cobra number 2, Rassel number 5, Titans number 15, Wednesday Comics number 2, and the Big Prince Valiant hardcover that came out from Fantagraphics last week. So without further ado, here we go. First up is JSA vs. Cobra, Engines of Faith, number 2, written by Eric Troutman, penciled by Don Kramer, inked by Michael Babinski, and I want to talk about the colors by Art Lyon because they really complement the art. This miniseries is, in many ways, a continuation of Eric Troutman's work with Greg Rucka as co-writers of Checkmate. It picks up with Mr. Terrific, who is a high mucky muck in Checkmate, as well as being a member of the Justice Society of America. And this miniseries so far has done an excellent job of contrasting Mr. Terrific's two roles, mostly by having him play off of Power Girl, who is the chair of the JSA, while the team tracks down Cobra, a terrorist cult, or a cult filled with terrorists, you know, potato, potato, who have attacked the Justice Society and are now causing trouble pretty much all throughout DC's version of the United States. In this particular issue, we've learned that Cobra is frequently two steps ahead of Mr. Terrific and Power Girl, which is too bad because it looks like Cobra is after this super secret, super powerful generator that Star Labs is developing. Two issues in, I think this is shaping up to be an excellent miniseries. It is just as good as I remember Troutman's work from Checkmate, and the art is really something I'm not used to seeing from Don Kramer. This will sound like another backhanded compliment, but his art usually does not have the sort of weight in its figures that this demonstrates. I'm guessing that's due to the presence of Mr. Babinski and Mr. Lyon, on the colors. Not that Don Kramer is a bad artist, far from it. I should say these three gentlemen complement each other's work very well. And Troutman does a good job keeping the focus, too, on Mr. Terrific and Power Girl. Power Girl kind of sees Checkmate as a sort of Dick Cheney-esque shadow government type of agency. It's actually run by the United Nations, for whatever that's worth. And their back and forth has fueled a good bit of these first two issues. The JSA is currently constituted, has a boatload of characters as well, and I'm glad that, you know, I'm sure they're fine characters, but I'm glad that Troutman is keeping the focus on Mr. Terrific and Power Girl, and also bringing in Alan Scott, the original Green Lantern, who is also a Checkmate functionary. Although he really doesn't participate in the, like I say, the back and forth between Mr. Terrific and Power Girl. Anyway, it's a fine issue. This has turned out to be, an excellent miniseries. It's given me a lot more respect for Troutman as a writer. It's actually made me more eager to read his upcoming work, solo work, and it's made me appreciate his contributions to Checkmate. So, if you're not getting JSA vs. Cobra, by all means, check it out. There are only two issues so far, so it's pretty easy to get into. Next up is Rassel number 5 by Jeff Smith. This is a comic that comes out, I think, quarterly, so it's kind of hard to keep track of where everybody is in the story. But fortunately, it's a pretty simple story about a guy who has a sort of parallel universe hopping rig that he uses to have adventures and cause trouble on Earths which are not his own. And this issue is actually pretty enjoyable on its own merits, because it gives us a lot of backstory on the main character and his modus operandi. In fact, judging by this issue, our main character tends to use his device to hook up in whatever parallel Earth he finds himself. Like I say, I like this issue. I probably need to find the other four issues. They're scattered somewhere around the house, so I can get a better appreciation for the story as a whole. But that is my shortcoming, and it's not Mr. Smith's. So there you go. Next up is Captain America number 601. As a little aside, it's an issue I didn't expect to see. I thought Captain America was going on hiatus until the Reborn miniseries was over, but this is a nice bonus. It's written by Ed Brubaker and painted by Gene Colan. Well, that's not accurate to say that it's painted by Gene Colan. It says art by Gene Colan, color art by Dean White. But it has the effect of a painted comic book anyway. It's a pretty simple story when you get right down to it. It's an untold tale of the original Captain America and Bucky at the towards the end of World War II, and they're fighting vampires. The in-joke here, I suppose, is that Gene Colan drew Tomb of Dracula for many years for Marvel. His art is very moody. I hesitate to say it's impressionistic because I'm probably misusing that word. Of course, Gene Colan also drew Captain America back in the day. There's a nice little biography, one-page biography of Gene Colan on the last page of the issue. And I mention that because it sort of shows you the range of that Gene Colan had and has as an artist, and how he's able, in this issue, for example, to blend the red, white, and blue superheroes, Captain America and Bucky, with, you know, vampires and the sort of shadowy creatures of the night kind of thing. So the art is the real attraction here in Cap number 601. And that's a good thing because the story, it's a fun story. Cap plus vampires and Nazis. Like I say, my one complaint with the story is that it flashes back. It contains a framing sequence with today's Bucky Barnes and Nick Fury reminiscing about Steve Rogers and the good old days of World War II. It then flashes back to February 1945, and then Steve Rogers flashes back to his, you know, days before he got the super soldier formula. And at that point, I was like, oh my gosh, is the super soldier origin story going to be part of, you know, every other Captain America story, like the like they say about Batman, his middle name is practically My Parents Are Dead. So nested flashbacks aside, I didn't really have any complaints with the story. The art is nice and moody and just what you'd expect from Gene Colan. Brubaker keeps the story moving, and it's a good, I hesitate to call it a fill-in issue, but it's a good issue of Captain America. So what more do you want? Next we have The Brave and the Bold number 25, which teams up Hardware and Blue Beetle. Hardware is a Milestone Comics character who's been recently imported into the DC universe. So this issue is the latest in a series which teams up the Milestone characters with established DC universe superheroes. The issue was written by Adam Beechin, penciled by Roger Robinson, and inked by Hilary Barta. And it's basically a Hardware story, which I get the feeling is setting up future subplots for whenever Hardware appears again. Hardware is essentially a character who built his own super suit. This isn't doing justice to the character, I know, but I'm not a real Hardware scholar. He's always seemed to me to be kind of, what if Iron Man were working for Tony Stark, and Tony Stark were exploiting him, and then Iron Man got sick of it. So the whole story is about this criminal outfit called The System, who are old enemies of Hardware. They've figured out how to short circuit or, you know, shut off key systems of his armor, and they do so. They then attack him with guys in their own armored super suits. Meanwhile, Blue Beetle, who just wants to be everybody's friend, is trying his best to be Hardware's friend. In the end, as a result of the two teaming up, they fight off The System, and, you know, the day is saved. I found this to be a quite enjoyable issue. It's lively. It has a lot of good dialogue between Blue Beetle and Hardware. The art is appropriately crisp and detailed, considering that these are characters who both have their own super suits after a fashion, and they're fighting other guys in super suits, so that's you know, it suits the subject matter in that regard. It's nice and energetic, dynamic. There are quite a few fight scenes, as you might expect. But the point is to introduce Hardware, or I should say reintroduce him to regular DC Universe readers, and I think this story does that quite well. Moving on, we have Agents of Atlas number 8, written by Jeff Parker, penciled by Carlo Pagulian, inked by Jason Paz with Noah Salonga. And it teams up the Agents of Atlas with the Hulk. Well, team up is probably a poor choice of words. On the first page of the issue, a pair of ne'er-do-wells abduct a drifter with no identification. Since we have seen that the Hulk is on the cover, I think we can all guess who the drifter really is, and that the ne'er-do-wells are going to get what's coming to them before too long. And in fact, they do. The twist involves the agent's connection to the Hulk's abductors. But as usual, the fun is in seeing, you know, how the different agents of Atlas interact with each other and with the Hulk. Specifically in this issue, Temujin, who is the Frank Burns of the group, tags along on the mission, so hilarity ensues after that. Considering that I think we all know, as I say, what's going to happen from pretty much the first page of the issue, Jeff Parker does a good job keeping everything moving, keeping the characters on their toes, and providing a good explanation for why the agents of Atlas, who are pretty powerful characters despite their obscurity, couldn't just take out the Hulk within about 5 minutes or so. The art is good. Thanks to the colors of Jenna Shermer and Elizabeth Dismang, it has sort of a washed-out watercolory effect, which is really nice to look at. The fight scenes are handled pretty well, and overall no complaints about this issue. Plus, if you look at the recap page, the origin of the Agents of Atlas is rendered to the tune of the Brady Bunch theme. I'm not sure that it tracks entirely, and I am definitely not going to try and sing it for you here now. So I'm just going to have to take Jeff Parker's word on that. Next is the newly expanded Action Comics number 879, lead story written by Greg Rucka, penciled by Diego Olmos, and inked by Bit. The second feature is Captain Atom, which is written by Rucka and James Robinson, with Robinson handling the scripting and Kefu providing the art. The lead story winds up Nightwing and Flamebird's fight with who Rucka has been calling the Bonnie and Clyde of Krypton. Nadira and Azrael, also joining the fight, is Codename Assassin and his squad of goons. Codename Assassin's mission is to hunt down every Kryptonian who's made it to Earth, and he makes the mistake of making Flamebird very angry, angry enough to display a new power, which kind of reminds me actually of the Peter David Supergirl, who actually wasn't Kryptonian, so it's probably just a coincidence. At any rate, lots of fighting in the lead story. Codename Assassin fights Flamebird, everybody fights Nadira and Azrael, but it all sort of feeds into the political maneuvering behind the scenes that I have come to enjoy in Rucka's work. Also, Lois Lane and Mon-El do a little bit of detective work, but that's a spoiler potentially, so I won't go too much further into that. The Captain Atom story is unrelated, although Cap is working for the United States government, or for the military probably, but that doesn't mean he's affiliated with the military types we see in the lead story. At any rate, his mission is to storm this sort of medieval fantasy type castle, which is defended by archers and mystic beasts and magic, and naturally Captain Atom, who is powered by the fundamental forces of the universe, is making pretty short work of them until he starts having strange flashbacks and the story ends on a cliffhanger. It's a nice little story, nice little twist at the end. speaking as someone who read Captain Atom back when it was an ongoing series in the late 80s, early 90s, and who's followed the character since then, I'm still not clear how Cap got back to sort of his original status quo as a government agent with his original look, or his original revamped all-silver look at least. But I'm hoping that that'll be explained in future issues. It doesn't make any difference for this little story, which is, as I say, enjoyable enough on its own terms. And before I forget, I like the lead story as well, the Nightwing and Flamebird story. It's a well-done fight scene, essentially. I know my colleague Tim O'Shea at Robot 6 had some problems with the way that Rucka writes Kryptonian. He puts Kryptonian characters in the word balloons, and then he places subtitles at the bottom of each panel, which can be a little bit distracting. And I didn't mind it at first, but it's starting to distract me as well, making me wonder whether, you know, it's a nice touch, but again, in the old days, you just have the foreign language in between a pair of brackets and a little footnote saying, hey folks, we're speaking Kryptonian. But that's a minor complaint. I'm getting into the Nightwing and Flamebird storyline, and I'm looking forward to where Rucka and Robinson take these characters. Batman Streets of Gotham number 2 is up next. Its lead story was written by Paul Dini, penciled by Dustin Nguyen, and inked by Derek Friedolfs. And my complaint about issue number 1, which I enjoyed issue number 1 generally, but I thought that it was maybe a little bit too ambitious and a little bit too unfocused. It attempted to introduce several characters, including Batman and Robin, some new characters, and some returning characters, and it only really seemed to come together as a story of the supervillain Firefly terrorizing Gotham City. And this issue is kind of the inverse of that, because it's mostly about Batman and Robin fighting Firefly, who, by the way, is a flunky of the crime lord Black Mask. But Dini then brings in a couple of the new characters he introduced last issue, and I had to remind myself that that's who those characters were. Anyway, as a standard Batman versus supervillain story, I thought this was pretty enjoyable. There is not as much sense that this is a new Batman and Robin as there is in, for example, Batman, the flagship Batman book, or the Batman and Robin book. And I especially don't get the same sense of Damian Robin as a character that I do as those in those other two books. But I suspect that that is not the point of this book. I continue to enjoy the art. It has its own particular style, which is sort of a Mike Mignola-esque, heavy on the blacks and the shadows type of thing. The line work is thinner than I think Mignola uses, but, you know, different strokes. Ha 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 ha. Sorry about that. The story also advances a subplot which has been percolating under Dini's guidance for several months now, and that is Tommy Elliot, the lamest Batman supervillain in a long time, masquerading as Bruce Wayne, which he's now able to do out in the open since everybody in the superhero community thinks Bruce Wayne is dead and can't really say anything without revealing that Bruce Wayne was Batman. And as much as I dislike Hush, Dr. Elliot, a.k.a. Hush, I will say that what he does in this issue is pretty clever, and it sets up what we've been told is going to happen. It essentially makes him a viable character again, which I guess if anybody deserves a chance to rehabilitate Hush, it's Paul Dini. Anyway, as for the second feature, Manhunter, written by Mark Andreyko, penciled by Georges Jante, I hope I got that right, and inked by Dexter Vines. Manhunter, who is in reality Kate Spencer, the new Gotham City District Attorney, is hunting a serial killer called Jane Doe, and here we get some information, backstory, I guess, on Jane Doe. mostly through a trip to the half-destroyed Arkham Asylum. There is a nice little scene which I, thanks to my chosen profession, appreciated, where Kate talks to her intern about the ability to get a subpoena for Jane Doe's medical records from Arkham Asylum. The intern essentially argues that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in those medical records because she's a prisoner, or she was a prisoner. It's been a long time since I took criminal procedure, so I don't know if I entirely agree with that. I don't really have the background to agree to have an informed opinion on it one way or the other, but it sounded good, and I appreciated Andreyko having Kate Spencer and the people around her who are lawyers actually talk like lawyers. I'm not aware of whether Andreyko's a lawyer or not. He certainly done his homework. And of course, because this is a co-feature, it ends on a cliffhanger, and a dandy one at that. So I'm looking forward to the next issue. Now we are getting into the Blackest Night portion of the program with Titans number 15, which does have a tenuous connection to Blackest Night. It's written by J.T. Krall, penciled by Jose Louis, inked by J.P. Mayer, and it is about Tempest, the former Aqualad, who many years ago took a 500-level course in ancient Atlantean mysticism and is now, he's now an Atlantean sorcerer or a magic user, however you want to look at it. He has more powers than he did as Aqualad, that's for sure. This is essentially revisiting his origin, the origin of Aqualad, and kind of his history of being an outcast, like Aquaman was an outcast from Atlantis, and his coming to terms with the fact that Aquaman, the original Aquaman, Arthur Curry, a.k.a. Orin of Atlantis, King of the Seven Seas, is dead, and will probably be seen in Blackest Night as a zombified Black Lantern. My one complaint with this issue is a big one, namely, when I was reading the last Aquaman series, which featured Tempest, the character had lost most of his powers and, in fact, had lost his ability to breathe underwater. So he is essentially a shadow of his former self. And this issue makes no mention of that period and doesn't explain how he's regained his powers and is essentially back to normal. It's kind of the same complaint I had with the Captain Atom issue, or the Captain Atom story in Action Comics, but where that story was a reintroduction to the character, which only had, you know, a third or a half of the pages that this story does. This is a full issue devoted to Tempest, and, you know, it would have been nice to get a panel or two saying, hey, great, my powers are back. It's also not so much a Titan story now that I think about it, although Tempest was a Teen Titan and later affiliated with the New Teen Titans, and later with the grown-up Titans, and this is his big reintroduction to the latest iteration of the grown-up Titans. The only other Titan who appears in the book is Dick Grayson, and he's not Nightwing anymore, obviously, because he's Batman. And, you know, that's a nice scene. Tempest visits Batman in the new Batcave. They have a little chat about what it means to lose your mentor. And considering that the issue essentially builds to that scene, it's a successful issue. But I suppose we'll have to wait and see what role it plays in the greater scheme of things, both in Blackest Night and in the Titans series. It just seems like a story in search of a home, is what I'm saying. Next we have Blackest Night, Tales of the Core, number 1. The first of a 3-issue weekly miniseries spotlighting individual members of the rival Lantern Corps. Now, for the uninitiated, there are several different Lantern Corps groups which have sprung up in the past few years to compete with the Green Lantern Corps. There's the Blue Lanterns, the Yellow Lanterns, who are all evil, the Orange Lanterns, the Red Lanterns, the Indigo Tribe. Who am I forgetting? Oh, the Star Sapphires, and of course the Black Lanterns. And this issue spotlights the leader of the Blue Lanterns, St. Walker, in a story written by Jeff Johns and drawn by Jerry Ordway. And this is a story which is kind of, it's kind of a Twilight Zone. Imagine Twilight Zone doing Tales of the Old Testament, and I think you'll get a good feel for this story. St. Walker essentially is guided exclusively by his faith, and, you know, we've had discussions in Sunday school about if you trust God to do absolutely everything for you, including to what some people might consider absurd extremes, where would that get you? And again, that may not be entirely fair to the story, but it's kind of, I think, what Johns was going for. And it turns out, as I say, it's got kind of a happy ending because the Blue Lanterns are all about hope, but it's pretty rough getting there. It's a well-told story, I will say that. I've always liked Jerry Ordway, and he does a good job here. And it's kind of a departure for Johns because it's one of the more spiritually minded things that I think he's written. It makes me think that we will see a lot more of St. Walker, not only in Blackest Night, obviously, but after Blackest Night is concluded, and it kind of makes me wonder about the whole direction of the various colored lantern corps after Blackest Night. The second story in the issue is not strictly speaking about a member of the Sinestro Corps, but it's about the son of Mongol, Mongol being the alien dictator who has set himself up as the leader of the Sinestro Corps. It is written by Peter J. Tomasi and drawn by Chris Samney. And essentially, Son of Mongol is, it says many years ago, so I suppose this is actually Mongol, the kid who grows up to be Mongol. His dad was also called Mongol, so there's where my confusion came in. Anyway, this kid comes across a group of extraterrestrials who crash land upon his planet, and because he is the son of an intergalactic dictator who wants nothing more than to emulate his father, first thing he does is enslave them. And it's a rather darkly humorous story. The third story in this issue is just called A Tale of the Indigo Tribe. It introduces the mysterious Indigo Tribe, which is a heretofore unseen rival to the Green Lantern Corps, and the story itself is pretty inscrutable. The Indigo Tribe happened upon a Green Lantern who's been mortally wounded and a Sinestro Corpsman who's similarly wounded. They perform some voodoo on each of the combatants, and both end up dying. And we don't know exactly why or what the Indigo Corps did or how they feel about it, because we have no idea what they're saying or thinking or feeling. Mostly because the Green Lantern Ring is unable to translate their language. So that's pretty much a tease for the Indigo Corps. I suspect they'll show up in Blackest Night around issue 6 or so, coming in to save the day, and they'll probably end up being the key to the whole thing. So there you go. And that brings us to Blackest Night number 1, written by Jeff Johns, penciled by Ivan Rice, inked by Eau Claire Albert. It is a double-sized issue, the first of 8. So we're going to have a lot of Blackest Night to talk about between now and February. I've written a pretty, well, you know, as in-depth as I get, review of this issue for Robot 6, which should go live today, Thursday, the 16th. So to summarize, I enjoyed the issue. I have some problems with John's technique, but then I always had problems with the style of using narrative captions over thought balloons and omniscient narrators. Essentially, on the first 2 pages, Johns has 4 dialogue tracks for 3 characters, counting the narrative captions of the omniscient narrator who pops in to say things like, Sector 666. But basically, I thought that Johns, Rice, and Albert did a good job setting out the necessary points of DC continuity, which include a survey of who's dead in the DC universe, laying out the problem, essentially, that the Black Lanterns are getting ready to rise up and wreak havoc across the universe, and there's nothing that the Guardians of the Universe or the Green Lantern Corps can do to stop them. And then setting all of that in motion with a couple of sequences, one showing the rise of the Black Lantern Corps, made up of not only dead Green Lanterns, but also various dead superheroes and beloved supporting characters, who, among other things, attack a couple of longtime DC characters, and it does not end well for the living. There is a real danger here, I think, with all of the necessary exposition and philosophizing, that the issue could be overwritten. And I don't think Johns has done that. I think, again, I have a problem generally with using first-person narrative captions when there's a perfectly good omniscient narrator for the author to speak in his own voice and not try to put words in or put exposition in the mouths of his characters or in the thoughts of his characters. And when the four Earth Green Lanterns are introduced via Hal Jordan's first-person narrative captions, of course, I mentioned in the Robot 6 column that it kind of sounds like a boy band. You know, Hal is the dreamy one, and John is the stoic one, and Guy's the funny one, and Kyle is the sensitive one. But, you know, that's just me and the various subconscious issues that I have going on. This is essentially a zombie story. It made me wonder at first how Johns was going to stretch out a zombie story over 8 double-sized issues without making it seem padded. But the Black Lanterns look like a big enough threat that it'll take a few issues to figure out how to stop them, a few issues more to implement the plan, and then, you know, some time to wrap up and take care of any unexpected problems. I think the issue is paced well. I compare it to Infinite Crisis, which was also composed of double-sized issues. There were 7 of those. But this issue ends actually at a point further along in its story than Infinite Crisis was in its story. So in that respect, it's ahead of Infinite Crisis's pace, which is a good thing. I think it is reasonably accessible to a new reader, despite all of the work that Johns and his writing collaborators have put into building a new mythology around the Green Lanterns over the past 5 years. I think that's actually the most accessible part of it. If you know the basic Green Lantern Guardian of the Universe setup, I think you'll be fine. I think, as I said on Robot 6, where it kind of stumbles is trying to incorporate all the other DC continuity that's accumulated over the past several years, which Johns needs to incorporate into this story. Some of that, when it comes to specific characters, is kind of clunky. Some of it is actually pretty efficient, as when Hal mentions Nightwing story that in this issue we see influenced a decision of the Justice League. And Rice and Albert are good as always. I think Rice has really progressed as a storyteller since he did Rand Thanagar War back 4 years ago. It's on a par with his work in the Sinestro Corps War, and it's a promising start to what should be an entertaining miniseries. And I'm going to finish off this week by talking about Wednesday Comics number 2 and the Prince Valiant hardcover volume, the first in Fantagraphics series of Prince Valiant full-color reprints. This one covers 1937 and 1938. And obviously I'm talking about these two in tandem because Wednesday Comics attempts to recreate the feel of those old Sunday pages, which of course Prince Valiant is one of the leading examples of. And it's kind of ironic because Wednesday Comics is printed on newsprint, specifically to evoke that Sunday Comics feel, but this Prince Valiant volume has been digitally remastered. It looks gorgeous. I mean, I'm never going to have the experience of seeing an original newspaper Sunday page from 1937. But if it looked anything like this, oh my gosh, if the original Sunday pages looked this good, they would look like they'd been colored by a computer. The original pages must have looked really fabulous because these look really fabulous. Hal Foster, who created Prince Valiant, in these stories, I've read about, I don't know, about half the book, maybe 40% of the book so far. I'm not done with it yet. But they're very entertaining. They show sort of the variation and layout that he started to get into as he really got into the stories. The initial story is Prince Valiant as a young boy. Then he becomes a squire at Camelot. All the while he's obviously royalty, hence the name, but he's sort of moving up the ranks at King Arthur's court. And Foster, you know, obviously was a phenomenal artist. He drew some stunning landscapes. He had a good command of layout, like I say, and choreography. And you look at these, you can look at each strip in isolation, as I'm sure people did back in, you know, the late 30s, and enjoy them, enjoy each one on its own merits, but taken together, you know, one after the other, they show a nice variety and a nice way of building mood and tempo over the course of several weeks. And the Wednesday Comics features are starting to do that as well. Their layouts are changing. The Metamorpho strip is all one page, although it shows action happening at different points along the page. And they're starting to sort of separate themselves out in terms of storytelling, pace, and subject matter. And it, as such, it's starting to make me wonder, you know, is the Supergirl story going to be 12 weeks of Supergirl chasing Crypto and Streaky? The same with the Metal Men storyline, which is starting to show Dan DiDio's limitations as a scripter. And the Wonder Woman strip, which again ends with a "it was a dream, or was it?" moment. So the rubber's starting to hit the road here for Wednesday Comics. I think each of these features has at least something to recommend it. And you know, how can you argue with a Hawkman story where the next issue box advertises Mile High Clubbing? I suppose in the end I'm glad I get to experience Wednesday Comics in its original form, so I can sort of imagine what it must have been like to read those Prince Valiant Sunday strips back in the day. And I'm glad I have the Prince Valiant to imagine how Wednesday Comics is going to look when it inevitably is collected. And with that, let's bring this week of New Comics Roundup to a close. Thank you again for listening, and I will see you next week.